Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Overserved. I'm Ari Bendersky, and I'm here with my good pal and awesome co-host,
Maggie Hennessy. Hello.
And we're taking a deep dive with the people behind Chicago's thriving culinary scene. Most weeks, we invite guests on, a chef, a sommelier, a restaurateur, a farmer, or another one of the fabulous people who ply us with all the food and drink to learn more about their story, who they are, why they got into this crazy food world, and what makes them tick. This week, we are super excited to have Chef Curtis Duffy and his business partner, Michael Muser, of the now-closed Michelin-starred restaurants Grace and Avenues, in the hot seat to talk about their partnership and friendship, how they got their start in restaurants, and their crazy, highly anticipated restaurant ever, which opens next year in Fulton Market. But first, we need to thank our first sponsor. This podcast was made by Mess, a design, development, and content studio located in Chicago. Mess helps brands tell their story online and off. Find out more by visiting madeatmess.com. So normally, if you've heard this podcast in the past, you know that we like to jump in by talking about things in the news, things that we made, things that we ate. But we are really, really excited this week to have Curtis and Muser on the show that we want to jump right in.
Be honest, you know I talk a lot. So you're just like, there won't be time for any recipe week today.
That did factor into the discussion.
Yeah, exactly. Dude's going to start talking. He won't shut up.
And he's already talking right now that he won't even let me give a little intro and background
Two
guys.
Would you like to introduce yourself?
Not at all.
Great. Okay. So we're incredibly excited to have Curtis Duffy and Michael Muser joining us this week. Curtis came up through some of Chicago's premier restaurants. After working at Charlie Trotter's, he moved on to Trio with Grant Achatz and then to Alinea, where he was the opening chef de cuisine alongside Grant. Eventually, he set out to open Grace, which he outwardly said he wanted 3 Michelin stars and got them before the restaurant closed due to a breakdown with its main investor. He was also the subject of the 2015 documentary For Grace, directed by Kevin Pang and Mark Helanowski, chronicling his life. Now he's working on his comeback with the restaurant Ever. And a 30-year veteran of the restaurant industry, Michael Muser, worked as wine director and sommelier at Avenues at the Peninsula of Chicago, where he met Duffy, and the two earned 2 Michelin stars. He joined Duffy as a partner and general manager at Grace in 2012, which went on to earn 3 Michelin stars in 2015. Muser, who was named Sommelier of the Year in 2014 by Food & Wine magazine, returns as Duffy's business partner and director of operations at Ever, their new Chicago restaurant slated to open in 2020. He is also a new dad. Curtis Yay. And Michael, welcome to Overserved.
Thank you.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
We're super excited to have you guys.
So to start off, you guys both rode in on motorcycles separately. I mean, it would be cute if you rode, you know, back to back, but
nuts to butts.
So how often do you get to ride your bikes? And is that like a super big passion in both of yours?
You go, chef.
I don't get to ride as much as Michael does, unfortunately. But, you know, it's always been a passion for me. I've had motorcycles my entire life. So I started riding when I was 5 years old, and I love it to this day. It's a passion of mine.
I rode on the back of one motorcycle when I worked at a counter service restaurant in Western Springs, Illinois. I was 15.
Yeah.
The one ride was enough. Yeah. I think we went 38 miles per hour, and I was like, you know what? That's too fast.
Yeah, I think I was on the back
I'm
of one.
I'm a self-preserving creature, though, yeah. I think.
With my best friend from growing up, we were in Jamaica, and we were cruising down the streets of Negril, and I was like, it's fun, cool, but yeah, I'm good.
Yeah. Do either of you have a scooter?
No.
No, but I want one.
I have a bike.
Yeah. It provides you, if you have one and you use it right, it's like hitting light speed out of the city.
Yeah.
You know, that classic scene where everything just goes blurry and just...
Really?
And then you wake up a half an hour later and you're out in Morris or Utica on the River Road. It's beautiful out there, you know, and it provides you with an opportunity to get out. I mean, as Chicagoans, if you're not careful, you'll live your whole year within a set route. You
know, right.
You go to work, you come home, you go to work, you come and do your thing. You get on a bike and in 15 minutes you can roll through Gary and just see the craziest of things. You know, there's a dilapidated church in Gary.
Yeah.
That is epic. It's Romanesque. It's huge. And you can just stroll through it. No one cares. It's massive in structure and you can roam around it like a weirdo and it's all there for you to see.
So you guys also, I feel like a few years ago, I remember, didn't you go on a cross country motorcycle trip? Like what was that like and what kind of shenanigans did you run into or create?
Well, I mean, every year we go out to, we love to hit the Smoky Mountains. That's kind of our spot. So we'll team up with a small group of Chicago buds and just head out that way. Shenanigans include everything from shooting fire rockets at each other, fireworks, nonsense.
Pranks.
But normally just stupid childish behavior.
So you get to be 16-year-old boys.
Twizzlers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we try to go at least one or two trips every single year. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, like Michael said, you're stuck in the city and you won't live your life. And we force ourselves to get out there and just get out and ride.
That's pretty awesome. Curtis, middle school home ec put you on your culinary path, but do you think it also saved your life? And what was it like working in restaurants and country clubs as a teenager?
Well, I would say in junior high, I had no idea even that I wanted to be a chef. I was just blessed to be around Ruth Snyder, who was saw something better in me than most teachers would just look away, you know, look the other way. She saw something in me. It wasn't until I was 14 when I actually stepped into my first kitchen as a dishwasher. And that's when it really started to spark. And I really think that I wanted to be a chef at that point either. But I love just being in a kitchen. I love just everything about it. Just, you know, after washing dishes, I was able to prep some food. And that was gratifying for me, you know.
What was it about it that kind of made sense to you that was just like something that felt like home?
I don't know. I'm not really sure. Yeah. For me, it was more about the food at that point. It was an instant gratification for me. It was being able to take something, some product, an ingredient, and transform it into something that you can eat in moments. And that was inspiring to me.
Was there anything you made early on that was sort of like I have a knack for this?
No, I don't think so. No, I tried to make a pasta dish for my parents one time and it was pretty good. I think they were just being nice. You know, I was still pretty young, so.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you've made now that you say, oh man, no, I'm just kidding.
No, never.
Clearly you have. What was kind of cool though, like when you mentioned Ruth Snyder's name, you lit up a little bit and it's been well documented that you had a pretty troubled childhood. Your dad was abusive and ultimately killed your mom and then himself. And Ruth had already been in your life for a few years. So talk about a little bit about who she is and how she helped you during that period.
Yeah, she became, even before my parents had passed away, she was always had this mother figure to me. She was always very nurturing and very sweet. And you know, obviously she didn't have to be. I was a student of hers and, you know, you cross that line and it's, at least these days, you get in a lot of trouble, you lose your job. And, you know, it was just very nurturing, you know. I remember this moment where we were in home ec class and we were in the section of sewing something. You had to make something out of fabric and we couldn't afford the fabric. I wanted to make a skateboard duffel bag to carry to school. And I remember that my family couldn't afford the fabric. And she pulled me aside and said, hey, you didn't bring your materials this week. What's going on? And I had to, you know, tell her that I wasn't able to afford it. My family can't afford it. And, you know, so then she came in the next day with all the fabric for me to make this skateboard. You know, it was pretty amazing, pretty special.
That's great. It seems like beyond being attracted to cooking after your parents passed away, it almost feels like at that point, and I could be wrong, but that it sort of awoke kind of a drive in you, then that sort of fueled this motivation to then kind of go on and take the path you have professionally. Can you talk about where your motivation comes from and maybe how your relationship to cooking changed during that time that was really tough when it feels like it was sort of a constant for you?
Yeah, as Ari said earlier that, you know, the childhood was rough. It was a lot of abuse and things like that. And for me, I always knew deep down in, like I said, I know I want to be a chef, but I knew I wanted something greater. I knew that I was hungry for it. I didn't know what it was at the time. And it was always that drive that just pushed me. And I think I got that work motivation, or I guess not the work ethic, from my parents, watching them, you know, hold multiple jobs to just put food on the table when he could. And, you know, I think that without knowing, I just accepted it and watched it. And, you know, after they had passed away, you know, at 14, I was already hungry enough to work. I wanted to work every day. And that's why I was working every day. And as time went on, I started saving money for a car so I could then work somewhere else out of the small town that I was in. And I just knew that I was something in me that I just wanted to keep pushing harder and harder. And it wasn't until I stepped into the second kitchen that I realized that, you know, this is what I really want to do, because then I was able to touch food a little bit more and you know, prep things. And it was just that ultimate, I don't know, it was that ultimate fire within me that I still have today, that just every day has to be better than yesterday.
Kaizen.
Exactly.
You can always be a little better.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think everybody can.
Yeah. Michael, you were born in Chicago, but grew up in California. What was it like growing up in California for you? And what's, was there a connection to Major League Baseball?
Yeah. So I was born August 8th, 1974, the day that Richard Nixon resigned as president.
Happy belated birthday.
Thank you very much. My dad always reminds me that he went to the hospital. As a matter of fact, he just told me this the other day. He was pinch hitting. Don't go baseball on me, because I don't know anything about baseball
at
all.
That's fine. I don't either.
Okay. So there was a
I'll
situation.
I'll keep myself under control.
Yeah. There was a situation while my father was playing for the Chicago White Sox on the night of my birth.
But your dad played for the White Sox?
Yeah. He played first base for the Chicago White Sox.
Wow.
Yeah. Way to do your homework, Ari.
Well, I mean, there's.
Like, I didn't know either.
You know something? You Google
well,
Michael.
You really don't know anything about baseball.
We're okay at other stuff.
Hold on.
Yeah.
You know, Michael, you Google Michael Muser, and you know what comes up?
What?
Curtis Duffy.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Why wouldn't
Forever it? In the shadow.
Yeah, exactly. Happily. No, my yeah. So, yeah, legitimately, my dad was a baseball player, and he was playing first base for the Chicago White Sox.
Wow.
And he just told me this the other day, because my birthday was coming up, and he always has to retell me the same story. And it was like he was pinch hitting for somebody or something happened, and he looked at his coach and whoever the manager was, and he goes, hey, can I go? My kid's born. And I was born in Palos Hills, Illinois.
Wow.
Proud as I can possibly be. But then as baseball players do, he got traded, right? And my parents are originally from Orange County, California. And so they had a house there back in the day. And they've lived in that same house ever since. I have an older brother, a younger sister. And growing up in Orange County is, yeah, go there. Boogie boards. Like, it was pretty, what it, you, yeah.
Super diverse community.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Super diverse.
Totally.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. we had a great, I mean, yeah, it was, you know, I think Duffy and I very much relate to each other as kids, in the sense that, you had a BMX bike and that was your ticket, dude.
Yeah.
You're on. That's all you needed. The mall is only 3 hours of a ride away, and that's got video games, so we're fucking going.
Yeah,
right.
Three hours on the highway shoulder.
Yeah, you know, it's why Napoleon Dynamite's so funny when he goes, I'm building a jump. Like, you were children of the 80s, man. No helmets, 100%. Just bricks and a piece of plyboard
and maybe
and
a couple
air.
Of nails.
Yeah, yeah, and air. So why am I talking about BMX bikes? Oh, growing up in Orange County, it was like that. I had that. But LA, after college, I was out. I mean, those freeways, that traffic, that lifestyle, that size of a fishbowl, yeah. The lack of identity that you don't feel, you know, I'll stand up for Chicago till I'm dead, because we're Chicagoans, you know.
Yeah. Like, but what brought you back to Chicago?
Well, I wanted to pick a city that I didn't have to drive a car in. I needed public trans.
Amen.
I needed affordable lifestyle. I needed to get a studio, or I was sharing an apartment at the time on like Diversey and Ashland, George and Greenview, right by the Southport Saloon, right across the street, as a matter of fact. And Chicago. And since that day, since I got to Chicago, man, this place has never not given me one thing I've asked for. Like, the city and I, she makes me work, for sure. You got to work for it.
Yeah.
But Chicago is that city. I swear to you, I'm a product of it. I came here wanting things. I was willing to kill it. I tried as hard as I could, and the city has given me everything I've ever wanted and more.
I think that's part of it, like the love of it, is that it does frustrate you. And there are moments where
you seven tickets.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
And you know what I mean?
I like that you stayed. That makes me feel very warm in my soul.
Yeah, that the city fights back. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You get in fights with it all the time, too.
Oh, yeah.
It's money. It's expensive. Yeah.
So how did you eventually get into restaurants? Was that always your pull? Like, did you always have an attraction?
Can't you tell I'm a failed actor? Can't you tell?
But you keep trying.
It all makes sense.
Yeah. Oh, it's all coming into view, Maggie.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was, I went to school, if you could call it that, as a theater kid, and then waited tables as any actor will, and then got bit by the wine bug. And that's kind of a universe that if you fall into that, sometimes you don't come out. I went in for years.
Was it the wine bug due to a mentor or was it due to being around wine?
You know what it was?
What sparked it?
When I was in LA, I worked for a big company called the King Seafood Company. And they were kind of divided half and half. They had these fish houses, which is kind of where I was born and bred. And then they had a fine dining division. And one of those restaurants was the Water Grill in LA. And that's a restaurant. I mean, at least back then it was a, you know what I mean? Michael Cimarusti was in the kitchen back then. Oh. Yeah. And he, yeah, exactly. Right. And this is back when Michael was a bear. I mean, that was the kitchen. The pastry chef was pissed all the time. And if you came anywhere near her shit, you were done. And Mike was a bear, man. And the GM was from like somewhere mean. And was just and ran the room in a way.
There's just like a meanness just pulsing through the place.
But then there's the cascades of stemware, right?
Yeah.
And the wine and the wine coming out and the ceremony around the wine and the pauses in the service pattern out of respect for all of the aspects that are going on. It wasn't just a restaurant. I saw it for the first time in the way that it was.
It's like a performance.
Yeah.
Is when done right, too, is really...
pre-shift.
Yeah, you almost don't... Like, I feel like we'll get into this later, but this idea that it almost... You don't know that it's all that's happening. Like, meanwhile, behind the scenes, it's crazy. But for you, it's just this beautiful thing you don't even really think about. It's just there sort of holding you.
Often restaurants like ours are still waters run deep. We're like, yeah. Everyone looks like ice, but underneath that... There's a back waiter that wants to punch a runner in the face so bad.
But I also find it really interesting because like the two of you are such a perfect balance for each other because Curtis, you are so much more reserved and quiet and behind the scenes.
No, he'll start talking soon and we won't be able to get him to stop. Right, I can feel it. It's going to happen any minute now.
But Muser is like, you are the performer. Like you need to be, or you want to be out in front of the people. So it's like, how do you balance? How did you know, like when you came together, because you met at Peninsula, right?
Yeah.
At the Peninsula at Avenues. Yeah. How did you, like, what was the first thing for you two that clicked when you realized that you had a special balance and relationship?
Your answer would be better.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was, you know, you see it in the documentary where you go, oh, I thought I was going to meet this French guy named Muser, blah, blah, blah.
Michel Muser.
Yeah, and, you know, for me, it was, we instantly clicked. It was an easy connection. We just, you know, we jived off of each other very easily. We started tasting food together, started tasting wine. And this was before I actually took over the restaurant. I had a few weeks to kind of develop the menu. And we're just giving food. And he's giving me wine. We're tasting. And I just knew, I don't know, 2 days into being there, I was like, this is my guy. He's going to end up with me the rest of my life building these restaurants together. And it just grew into a friendship, you know, as my brother, best friend. I obviously consider him my family now, obviously.
Yeah.
He's an incredible person. So it's easy that a lot of people say, oh, you're yin and yang. And he's absolutely, or a lot of people are absolutely right that, you know, I am reserved. I like to be quiet. I like to take in information and then deal with it. Him, he's just 100% go, which is awesome.
It's interesting because it sounds like it was first like a respect for him professionally. And yeah. Then the friendship kind of grew out of that, which is...
Yeah. Well, when Curtis says awesome, he means awesome and awful too, right? Like we communicate differently, right? So we have to be very I'm an idiot. I'm an emotional, Curtis will tell you, I say all the time, I'm not angry. I'm just being loud. I'm not mad. I'm just me, you know? And Duff, definitely, he don't say a lot. And then when he does, it moves the earth between everybody's feet in a kitchen. That's how awesome. That's what I love. You know, I love that. When we met, for me, it was there all the friendship and all that stuff too. Also, there's the side that we were inside the Peninsula Hotel, so you need protection in that environment from the executive committee and so on and so forth. You don't want them coming at him. And for me, it was his voice on the plate. I'm telling you, I see him. I've seen him. I know cooks. I know lots. And I wouldn't be sitting in this chair just out of friendship and love alone, although I do love him and he is my friend. But it is a voice that deserves protection and needs to be heard. It's unique, I promise you. And I stand behind that more than, you know, any friendship or anything like that. The dude's an artist, legit, real, on the plate. And he deserves a platform to be able to do that without any interference or trouble.
So you guys earned 2 Michelin stars at Avenues. You have global acclaim, recognition. Where was the motivation? What was the moment that you decided that you're like, we got to get out of this place. We have to do our own thing. Like Michael's pointing at Curtis right now. Was it like, did you always know you wanted to have your own restaurant? Was what pushed you out of the peninsula?
You know, it's always been a dream of mine to have my own restaurant. When I started working years ago, long before the awards were ever there or even eligible for me as a cook to gain, I had that idea and that want to have my own restaurant. Michelin wasn't even in the city. When did they come in? 2011,
I think.
12 years ago or something like
that. I think 2011, because I was at Eater then.
Okay.
Yeah, so like I think 2010 or 11 was the first year.
I remember when we all got the email that said, come to this event space to celebrate the coming of this book. And everyone was looking at everybody like, oh, dear God.
Right.
Yeah, because it was invite only. It wasn't just everybody.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Yeah, so it was, you know, long before the awards. And it's always just been a drive of mine to have my own space, my own restaurant.
But were the awards part of that? Like the want to achieve a certain acclaim, was connected to? Okay.
It's never been about the awards. It's not my driving force. It's not even the money side of it is not even my driving force. It's the ability to create and, you know, like Michael said, have my voice out there every single day. It's, if I was a painter, if I couldn't paint, it would be frustrating for me.
Yeah.
So going back to like the awards not being motivation, when you got the 2 Michelin stars at Avenues, you said you wanted to get the third. Then when you announced that you were going to do Grace, you said you wanted to be a 3 Michelin star. So like, was it more about, were you setting the stage for people to have the expectation that it was going to be an incredible restaurant? Or was that for yourself to say like, this is what I want to reach with what I'm doing?
Yeah, I think it was a foolish thing to say. You know, I think
looking back on that,
looking
now.
Back on instead of a few foolish things, but you know, you put it in the universe. Yeah. You want it. You know, how do you not control what you want? You know, obviously with the 2 Michelin stars, I knew with what we had and what we were surrounded with, that I felt like we could achieve something greater if we had full control over it from the moment you walk in the door to the moment you leave.
Yeah, right? Like to put it in frame of reference. You know, we're employees of the Peninsula Hotel, right? So in the documentary, you hear Curtis go on this unbelievable rant in the beginning. When I first saw it, I was like, oh my God, right? Because they're friends, you know that. We love them. They love us. So it was like, oh, here goes stuff, you know? But that frustration was real, right? There are budget. Come on, dude. It's a company. There are budgets. There are this, there are that. You don't get coffee cups this quarter. Why not?
This year.
No, you can't hire another captain. And listen, I don't care that the expediter quit. Let Muser do it. That's why I'm expoing in the documentary, because there was no one else to do it. And Curtis, and an expediter is God almighty during service.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Expo runs house.
Yeah.
So it had to be somebody that knew what was going on. In that moment to get 2 Michelin stars there, where we were not feeling very happy in the amount of toys that we had to play with, it just begged the question, Ari. What if he had all his toys?
Right.
What if he had all the things he wanted? What if I set him up for success in the way I know I could? Is it a star away? Let's find out.
Yeah.
And that was honestly Grace and a handbag was 2 kids going, can we? Could we?
And you
did.
Do
you think maybe? And then way faster than we wanted, we did.
Right.
And at that point it was like, whoa, damn. And then the next couple years were a process of kind of feeling it a little bit and just kind of like seeing it, you know, in the way that Neo at the end of the Matrix plucks that bullet out of the, you know what I mean? He goes, no, I can see you. I get all the bibbly bops over there.
But I've also talked to chefs who've kind of said that once you have it, then there's this like, oh God, I have to maintain.
Are you kidding? Yeah.
Yeah.
With every breath you take.
Exactly. That sort of high pressure. I mean, it seems to me that that's just like, I don't ride motorcycles over 38 miles an hour without thinking I will die. YouTube.
Run a three Michelin starred like restaurant and you'll see why you ride one at 175 miles an hour. Right. See, it seems it.
Yeah. It seems like it sort of like, what is it about that? Because they're beyond having a platform to create what you want to create, the way you want to create it and package it and give it to the customer in this, you know, this very controlled, just beautiful, this is what it's supposed to be. There's also something to be said for being attracted to that sort of super high pressure, never lets up. How do you handle that, and do you relax from that, or is it? I mean, that just feels like a state to be in that's difficult.
So I look at the maintaining the three Michelin stars. I always say, look, we're doing something great to get it. Continue doing something great to maintain it. Why change a lot of things to, you know, when we did get the three Michelin stars, we went through a period of like that moment of like, oh God, okay, we got to make sure every single fork is like perfectly straight and all of these moments. And that's when I realized like we did something great to achieve it. Continue down that path.
So I don't want to get like, I think this was a broader version of the question that you were asking, which is got asked to me the other day by Dave Hammond for a New City interview where, you know, the classic, you know, do we need these things, these widgets, this ever widget that I'm about to, you know, that we're making?
Yeah.
Why do we need this? You know what I mean? What's the point? I love the one, is fine dining dead? Shut up, I say to that. Shut up.
I sighed at that.
But there will always be people who want that level of service and are willing to pay for it.
Like, and I understand that person saying that thing. I know how many cheeseburgers at Au Cheval you can get for one price of one ticket to one of our things. I get it. My favorite meal of the week is Superdog and Skokie. He knows that. It's like my one thing I hit. I love it. I get it. But there's absolutely no reason in any other art form that we don't reach up, you know? Mm-hmm. And when you have the opportunity to do so, then you have the responsibility to do so.
Right.
Why that environment? Why care that much? Why want that much? Why? Because we know how to do it. And we know how to do it really well. If anything the past 5 years has taught us is we're really good at that.
But then with Grace, there was obviously this pretty abrupt closure and the series of lawsuits. I'm not sure how much you're able
to
talk about.
Abrupt in the way that it was announced.
Well, in the way it was announced. For you, it was probably like, yeah, that's true. You're living it every day.
Yeah, was the, for you guys on the backside, for like people who didn't know anything going on, like how long was this leading up to?
Years.
A couple of years.
Really? Because how long was Grace open for?
5 years.
5 years?
Yeah.
And so the last 2 years were tumultuous and frustrating and...
I would say probably the last 2.5-3 years.
What brought that on? I mean, how, coming from a perspective of like, you put so much heart and soul and money into this restaurant, you achieve the stars, and then things on the backside start breaking down. Like, what was going on and how did that make you feel?
It's tough to talk about because, you know, it's basically like, you know, tell me about the day you walked out to the barn and shot your favorite horse.
Jesus.
In the head.
Great visual. Thanks
is
for that.
Is that really what it felt like?
Thanks for listening, everybody.
You know what's funny? I just did...
Don't tell me what they're going to do to old Yeller. I think they're just going to let him outside.
Exactly.
He ran away.
I just did that, I want to call it Between Two Ferns. Between Two Bites? Between Bites.
Between Bites. Mm. I was there.
Okay.
Remember I read.
That's right. And Leah Omelinsky, do you remember her story about how she, when the fall of Nico for her, right? Yeah. That was an unbelievably tentative reminder to me. How we as restaurant folk, we marry our brands. Even if you're just an employee, you marry it, you become it. It is you, right? I say all the time at any restaurant I'm running, this is not what you do. This is who you are.
Right.
This is a representation of who you are. Every napkin fold, every time you polish a piece of stem, right? And I, you know, go on in that way. And she reminded me that day that so if Lee felt that way about Nico, you can imagine where Duff and I were about Grace.
But I think that's interesting because marrying it so much to yourself, it reminds me of kind of, I think people want to understand that because it's like, well, I have like this part of my life, this personal life that's just for me, and I do what I want and I relax.
Right.
And so I think people are, the reason people keep asking why is because that's something that a lot of people just can't really understand, committing to at that level and making it kind of attached to your identity in such a way.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's ugly. And when it splits, they're like the epic divorces of all time, right?
Yeah.
When you're in our position, you're always like, but if I'm not that, everybody knows that I'm that. What would they, what am I now if I'm not that?
With Ever, you're working with investors again, yeah?
Isn't that lovely?
Wait, so actually, before we get into that, I mean, what was the cause? Like, why did it break down?
And we were miserable.
Yeah.
We were miserable. And, you know, God, it's hard to talk about. Listen, you're assuming that if we disagree, if you were on the other side of us in that situation, you're assuming we disagree with you about something, we come to you and you listen to me. You're assuming that. You're assuming that if you're the owner of Grace Restaurant and Chef Curtis Duffy comes to you with an issue, you're assuming your response would be, oh my dear God, Chef is upset. What can I do, Chef?
Right.
You're assuming that. Don't assume that.
So he came back and was just like, I don't care. Like, deal with it. That's what it is.
Here's a match and where's the gasoline and let's burn this bitch down.
And that's kind of what happened. Like when you guys, you know,
when given no option, right? Now I have to understand we're employees,
right?
Right.
What is my?
Which I think that was also a really big surprise.
I am an employee. I work there like a cashier works at Target. So what am I going to do over to the owner Target guy? Hey, Mr. Target. Yeah, cashier Mike. I'm really upset about some stuff. Well, cashier Mike, you can quit. Okay, Mr. Target. And every move not to go out to that barn and not shoot that horse was made, brother.
Yeah.
Every move.
So yes, Chef?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean,
for 2.5 years.
That's got to be tough.
Tried.
Dude. And then,
But then also being locked out, you had an 18-month non-compete. Like, what were you able to do to stay afloat and
to work,
to make money?
Yeah.
Live.
Well, we didn't. It sucked. I just had a kid.
Yeah.
When did you have a kid?
So she was born on September 20th and she turns 2.
So, Grace closed December.
Oh, right there, man. Right
yeah.
there.
Wow.
Right there.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
2 months.
Away. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Living in that K Tower in the West Loop where that dude shot that dude on the elliptical. That was a lovely night. Let's not go there, Ari. Unless you want a 6-hour podcast, I can tell you. But you know about that, though,
we will
right?
collectively okay. just put a pin in
that. We could
that
talk
one.
About that in the after show.
Okay.
We don't have an after show. It's an after party.
We have canned wine coming up later. Yes, so
join us next on Super Overserved and Vomiting.
So, head in toilet overserved.
Jamie and I just had Ella. Curtis has 2 children that he has to support, right? Imagine being on the other side of forcing that too, right? We were in trouble. We were in big trouble. The thing is though, and the truth of it is, all right, I had to go to work.
Right.
I had to hit pavement in the face of all of that, in the face of no money coming in and only money going out and both of our lives in total shakeup and the hurt and the pain. You know, I try and downplay it, but you don't. I mean, it's not every day you quit your job and call the fucking New York Times. That's weird.
Yeah.
Right.
So what did you do in between?
I'm a waiter. Do you understand that? Yeah. I wait tables. Like, that's who I am. Like, why is this happening to us? Right. I would say a million times in the process.
So Curtis, what did you do? What'd you?
You know, I turned inward and spent a lot of time with my family and just really enjoyed those moments. And, you know, Michael and I had to do a few events to put some money in our pocket to, you know, it's, you know, buckle down. And, you know, thankfully I had enough money in my savings account and to kind of live. But, you know, you're not living like you normally do. You have to make sacrifices and adjust. And yeah.
How old are your daughter? You have 2 daughters?
I have 2 daughters.
How old are they?
One will be 14 in December and 10.
Wow.
The fun years.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So you always knew, like, I feel you probably both learned a lot of important lessons during this 18-month lockout. And what are you What are you taking from that experience and putting it toward ever?
In what respect? As far as
in terms of in everything, like personally, professionally, financially, partnerships, and things like that. Like how? Like what are some like takeaways that you guys had experienced during that time that you can say like I'm going to do this differently now because X happened?
Don't take your hands out of your pocket without your lawyer next to you.
Okay, we have to talk, Bo. You're working with investors again. Let's come back to that.
Oh yeah, well, I mean, just
how do you prevent another grace?
The other thing is too, like after that. We had to rebuild, right? And you just wonder, like, how does one go about this, right? Did I go to business school? Do I have an MBA? Do I sound like I have an MBA? You know what I mean? What am I doing, right? How do I start this process? Where does, what, and you know what it does? It's your phone. You think that it's different. It's not. I mean, it's literally, go to a coffee shop, open your Mac, figure it out. Get on your phone, call people that you know. And it's, you know, who do you call? Rich people. People that you know that are rich. And you just call them and say, listen, where, you know what I mean? Would you be interested? Would you not? It's cold. I had to do that. Yeah. Awful. Awful. I had to meet people for drinks. I don't like that.
That's funny because you're somebody who plies people with drinks.
I know, but yeah. it's just not on my fun list. But it was a brutal process. It was a brutal, brutal process because when you do find a P word, a partner, then you have to talk about for long periods of time, months, divorcing each other. And you have to dig into every moment of it. And you fight up, you know what I mean? You're on conference calls. It's like four or five lawyers. And the funniest ones was I would call Curtis afterwards. And I go, dude, we talked for 2 hours about after you die. Like, you know what I mean? Like what if Curtis dies? What if this, what if that? It's like, well, who would own his face? Who would own his shoes? Who would own this? Who would own, like, it's so weird because he's a product in a way, right? So everyone's talking about rights to him, this and that and the other. I mean, it got cut up a million different ways. It was
that's
got
to be sort of weird to be. That's like out of body experience.
Yeah. Well, we were making a joke the other day. It's like I am now super comfortable with the four of us, meaning my other business partners. You guys can talk about my death in front of me all the time because it's happened so much, and I'm always like, "Hey guys, I'm right here."
So
don't forget.
But so, when did you stop mourning Grace, and when did Ever kind of start to take shape in your minds, and then? Were you able to like really start pursuing this idea?
We've always had an idea to do a second, third, fourth, and fifth restaurant. That's really our ultimate goal, is to have multiple restaurants. So did we want Ever to be number two? No, but it was always, we've always talked about second restaurant. Yeah. So it was there. It wasn't in great detail, but it was there.
Yeah, we wouldn't have done Ever if we didn't think that the city didn't want it or need it. You know what I'm saying? I truly do. I know it's going to be a really expensive restaurant.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, with TM Zeter, most expensive restaurant. Shut up. It's not.
So what? It's like 200 to 500?
It's somewhere. Well, here's what we'll do. Ready? Here's our process. It's super complicated. About 90 days before we open, we'll call our competitive set. We'll price them out and we'll park ourselves in the middle. What we always do. That's what we do. And our competitive set is all those expensive restaurants. So we'll be somewhere up there, right? We'll offer it. We're very good at evaluating what we're offering. And we're very cautious about, you know, the price point that we put in front of it. But the city deserves to have multiple landmark moments that cause people to leave the airport and park themselves downtown and rent a hotel room and eat at four or five of these joints.
Right.
We're not focused on competing amongst inside of Chicago. I'm more interested in Chicago competing with Seattle.
And San Francisco. And New York.
Yes, chef. Yeah. And San Francisco.
Oh, you just call me chef.
Yes. I'm serious though. You know what I mean? Like that's what we should be concerned with.
Right.
You know, I would rewind the clock like 10, 12 years ago when we were at the Peninsula and Danny Grant was at Rhea. And Fernando Betata was the wine director at Nomi, and Nomi had like feet, man. They were cooking.
They were huge.
And
and True was breathing, and L2O was like this crazy rumor everybody was talking about because billions of dollars were being put inside of it. And we were at Avenue scraping it, just wanting to fight. And Alinea was like this godlike creature spoken by, I mean, come on.
So what can you tell us about Ever? I mean, first of all, you spent $2.5 million reportedly on Grace. What's this build out going to be? Like, what is it going to look like? Can you talk about what the experiences that you know of right now?
Do you want to do? I don't know.
I also would like to hear the.
Honestly,
I know, right? Well, he doesn't like for me to talk about much of it. I can tell, like, here, I'll say this. Grace, as we looked at it all throughout the process, for me, it reminded me a little bit too much of the set of The Golden Girls.
I don't remember any pastels at all.
Please take me inside your mind.
Okay, Grace was very
not much
beige-y.
Wicker.
It was very beige-y. It was very mauve toned. It was very muted.
Right.
Right. It was very muted. It was just plain, and because all we wanted was a spotlight on Curtis's plates.
Right. So Ever's going to be glitter and rainbows?
No, but we grows up a little bit.
Yeah.
Right. And we underpunched a little bit over there. And we felt a sense of ownership in the sense that we owned people a little bit of uppage on that front. And also too, Christopher Lawton and Micah Stanley, who designed Grace with us. They're like our other set, our other half of architectural brotherhood. They were ready to get some too, a little bit. Everybody wanted to get up a little bit and go, no, 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 no. This one's going to push. So the design of this restaurant is much more opinionated, much more aggressive, much more intense. Everything about it is us going next level, let's go, turn it up.
Can you tell us anything about just like us? I obviously can't give anything away, but like in terms of storytelling on the plate or where your head is at creatively right
food
now
wise?
what we'll see.
I mean, you know, a lot of people always ask, what are you going to do different from Grace? Like, why do I have to change my food because I'm moving to a different location?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, that's the food is always evolving. That's always been my drive, is let the ingredients in the season speak for themselves, but push it in a creative way. And that will continue. We'll continue down that path. We'll stay within the seasons. We'll continue to work with all the local farmers and international products as we can. The food will continue to push forward. You know, it's still
like,
my
can
food.
Can you tell us anything like, it's my blue period? It's like, creatively, where is your head? And having gone through this and now starting this new chapter.
It's weird right now because even though I have dishes and a lot of conceptual things down on paper, those we'll probably never even see
the light of day.
Because we're still 6-8 months away.
Yeah.
And, you know, the real creative process comes from getting the ingredients in hand, right? So I don't know what I'll be feeling in 8 months from now.
Yeah.
You know, like when we opened Grace, I had 4 menus in set, ready to go, because I knew the craziness that was going to happen. Once we opened the doors, all of a sudden it's spring and we got to change the menu again. And now we got to come up with 30 new dishes. Like, what? I don't have time for that.
Yeah.
So that's why I said, let's do 4 menus in stone. We can start working on them right away.
Yeah.
Will we do that with Ever? I don't know. Probably we'll have a couple menus in place ready to go. I think we're slated for a spring opening of 2020. So we'll have spring, summer, and maybe some fall. But, they're all just ideas on paper. They're not fully conceptualized, tasted dishes out. And that can't happen until, we have the ingredients in hand.
Yeah.
It's noted that you've always excelled with vegetables. And now, finally, vegetables in the last few years have finally come to the forefront with a lot of other chefs around the country and around the world. Why do you think it took so many people to come up to that level? And what is it that you love about vegetables that people are finally realizing that they're so great?
It's the versatility of them. You know, how many different ways do you need to cook a piece of beef? You know, it's a beef, it's beef. You're not changing it. There's, 75 different varieties of carrots that you can do something with. There's the possibilities are endless of what you can do, and the varieties out there, they're just it's amazing. It's just very inspiring.
Yeah, and it's this way to grow your arsenal that, like, it's almost bizarre that this wasn't happening sooner with all the creativity. That's like, wait, this is just this whole literal bounty.
Something people never, like, I feel like I have to remind people of is we would get clients coming from far and wide into Grace to get his vegetable menu.
Yeah.
It was one of the most consistent things that would happen in the dining room. And he would serve beets to someone who despised beets since they were 5 years old and have their world changed by it and come back into the kitchen and go, dude, I don't know how you did that, but it was extraordinary.
Were you inspired by it? Because Charlie Trotter was like the first person to have a vegetable-focused tasting menu. Was that, did you get inspired by that, or were you interested in vegetables even before working there?
I mean, I always had an interest in vegetables. I would say, yeah, he probably inspired me and pushed me to think about it a different way for sure. Absolutely. Being like the main focus, because it's too easy just to take the piece of chicken off and then all of a sudden there's your vegetarian menu or your vegetarian course. And that's what usually happens at most restaurants. And how unexciting is that? You know, there's no passion in that.
Right.
Okay. I'm going to do one more because I'm curious. For you creatively, what are some things that make you most excited about food? Is it texture, temperature? Like, what are the places that for you to play within are just the most exciting?
For me, it's about giving the guest something that they're familiar with and giving them something that they're not familiar with. But I think it's very important to have some familiarity to each course, each dish, if you will.
Like an entry point.
Yeah, I mean, how can you say this was a great dish if you don't know what a beet tastes like, but I'm giving you something that looks like a beet, but it's not a beet. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to trick your mind. I want you to eat something, understand what you're eating, but also on that dish, there's something that's maybe you've never had before. Maybe it is a texture that you've never had or a flavor that you've never had. I never thought of chocolate and caviar. I never thought of this two together, but now this is amazing.
Just nudges you.
Yeah.
A little bit. Yeah.
You both come from a very distinguished restaurant background. And you're about to open another very high-end place. But do you ever think about opening something more casual that the like everyday people can enjoy?
Absolutely. That's our goal.
It is.
It is our goal to, you know, build this flagship restaurant once again called Ever. And then move on to give something to the city that's more casual.
Do you have an idea of like what type of cuisine you'd want to do? Like, do you have a dream?
You know, I'm inspired by so many different, mostly the Eastern world, you know, Vietnam and Thailand, Japan. I love those flavor profiles. Does that mean I'll do Asian restaurant? I'm not sure. We don't know. Okay. When the time is right, you know, something else we've always talked about is what do our chefs want? You know, the chefs have been with us for many, many years. They trained with us. I hate to see them leave. You know, why not provide them the opportunity within our company to have their own restaurant? And what do they want to do, you know?
Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about kind of in this sort of high pressure, long hours environment, how do you take care of staff? How both emotionally, but then also in terms of benefits and giving them kind of a good situation, make this a profession, not just a job.
Yeah, I mean, it's a whole can of worms with us where in a kind of overall statement of restaurants are the human beings inside of them. And that's it. Mm-hmm. You know, you can put all the fancy chairs you want and make this amazing thing, but it's the culture that is bred inside that restaurant. And the culture just starts day one with us. And we're all going to gather together and I'm going to make a deal with you. I'm going to give you every single tool you need to do your job to the standards for which I am about to set every single day we come in.
But I think what Maggie's asking about is beyond their level of expertise or professionalism, what will you be giving back to them in terms of like healthcare and wellness, things like that? I mean, is that
mental health, like all these things, like taking
care of? I don't want to talk about any of that.
Why not?
Yeah, exactly. No, Will, I was listening to one of your earlier podcasts and I can't remember who the guest was, but she mentioned to her fellow staff member,
Jennifer Kim.
She said kids.
I say that all the time, right? It's probably super rude to refer to your employees as kids, but you work for us. We're together now. It's you and me all the way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You get in trouble at 4 o'clock in the morning and my phone doesn't ring. I hurt my feelings a little bit. We're going to do everything we can within the financial structure of this thing to make sure that everybody feels taken care of in every way possible. But let me tell you, it's a struggle.
Yeah.
I mean, it is the fight every single day. It's the P word came into effect, the partners. That's why we structured in certain ways so that we could afford and have a backbone financially to be able to prepare ourselves to do the best job we can to make sure that everybody's cool. This one's real small as far as how much square footage we had allotted to us. Like, so much of that plays in to a lot of those questions. You know, what can you do for everybody? Do you have the square footage to be able to provide for the space to do this and that and the other? Ever's a place where we're just going to work a lot.
Yeah.
You know, it's just was made that way. It's, you know, each one kind of does what it does. And this one is designed to execute with extreme efficiency. And so how we take care of the kids, how we deal with them, how we feed that culture, what we offer them, how good we get at that. It's going to be a work in progress. It'll come as it goes for sure.
And will den mother Amy Cordell be on board?
Oh, there's no question about it. Yeah. Amy. So yeah, my heart that beats within my chest has a name and it is Amy Cordell. And she was with us at Peninsula and Avenues and Amy was at Charlie Trotter's prior to
She's a rock star.
She's an absolute rock star. And she now has a son and another one she just announced the other day. So she will have two kids. Wow. I will have one kid. And between the two of us, we'll figure out how to run this restaurant.
Yeah, because that's part of it too, having a kid. When you lead this kind of life, you have to make time. How do you make time?
Well, you know, in my downtime, I also got married. And
oh, congratulations.
Two stepchildren as well.
Oh, my God.
So you now have four.
So now I have the official Brady Bunch and a brand new dog. So,
and how old are the stepkids?
So we'll start with mine are 14, 10, 9, and 8.
Got the whole.
Wow.
So remember when he goes,
wait until they're all adolescents at once for you.
I can't wait for my oldest to start working because I'm putting her to work for sure. Friday and Saturday night in the dish machine.
Remember when Curtis goes, I don't have as much time to ride motorcycles as Muser does. That's why. Because he's got these four kids running around.
And walking the puppy.
And a dog. Yeah.
So how do you make time?
I get up early.
Yeah.
I mean, like anything that's important in your life, you make time for.
Yeah.
Right? You know, if you're passionate about working out, you're going to find time to work out.
Yeah.
Otherwise, get up earlier and work out. Yeah. Otherwise, it's not important to you.
Otherwise, don't sleep.
Otherwise, don't sleep. Sleep when you're dead.
Which everyone's discussed at length, your death.
Yeah.
With exactly. You sitting there. So
I'm good with that.
Right.
Yeah. It's like, so I'm going to stay awake as long as possible.
Exactly. Do you have, so there was a moment in the documentary where Grant Achatz talked about kind of being in Thomas Keller's shadow for a long time. And he talked about you kind of in the same way of like, you broke out and he would consider it kind of nothing less than good mentorship if you surpassed him. It was sort of like almost the goal. Do you see anyone, because you talked about kind of wanting to develop the talent that's been staying with you. Do you kind of see that? And how is that kind of, for me, that was a really kind of an important moment. And it felt sort of cutthroat to measure success in terms of, well, when he's surpassed me, that will feel, I think that's sort of how it was for him with Keller.
Yeah.
Do you have that? And are you kind of starting to see now with the younger chefs working for you, maybe someone's going to take you down?
Yeah, eventually they will. You know, that's the goal.
Yeah.
Mentoring has always been a thing for us within the restaurant, personally, professionally. We have to give back. We have to be able to teach these young kids to move on and better our industry. You know, and hopefully that they will move on and want that passion to exceed what we do. You know, we always say in the restaurant, we set our standards here, but it's your responsibility to exceed them every day. Yeah. And then it's my job to come in the next day and set them even higher. And by the end of the day, you should be trying to exceed them.
Yeah, these restaurants like Ever, and there are lots of these little widgets, you know, not a lot, but a few. The cultures are very similar, right? And they're very special when they're achieved properly. They attract, I always say they're like little, like, you know, martial arts temples, right? And that's like the master. And all the little student ninjas come from all over the, you know, the place. And they come there and they study under the expertise of the chef in that kitchen. And they swim and they bathe and they get this culture that just breeds this sense of, oh, let's be the best at what we do today. The best at what we can do. And then they go on and do other things. The fun wrinkle to that side of it, though, I think, is that these are relationships, right? So they end poorly, too. And that's okay, too. You know what I mean? Like, as right. a, I can tell you.
Yeah, that's so true.
Right? That as a restaurant owner, you get to stand there every day and everybody gets to break up with you and you don't get to break up with anybody, right? Because firing someone sucks because now you got to go get another one.
Right.
And that's what I end up saying to sous chefs all day long. Sarah saw, let's get her out of here. She did it. Okay, but then you have to go find another version of her.
Right.
And if you even angle that towards the dish pit, you're even more, you know, upset because like if that person leaves, those are really hard to find. Or people to run front services. Those are really hard to find. And so you, the last thing you want is to see somebody go. But sometimes, you know, you just stand there, and you know, can I, the classic for chef is, you know, hey chef, yeah, can I talk to you after service? You go, you know what? Notice.
That's the only reason why they want to talk to you. Yeah. Right. They have no interest though. Otherwise, then just to give you their notice. That's it.
Yeah.
It's so classic.
Well, yeah, again and again and
can
again.
Can I read to you from my diary after service?
Yeah.
can we kumbaya together? So speaking of that, like in that environment there that people are super psyched about, when Ever was announced, it was described as Curtis's magnificent obsession. What the hell does that mean?
I mean, it's, again, it's an obsession of what I do, what I love. It's, I've been obsessed with doing another great restaurant, you know, for a very long time. And now it's even more fine tuned with just, this is what I want. This is what I have to have.
Yeah.
And what do you, we were talking about, and like, you, oh, sorry.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt
Please.
You, but the obsession word, you know, a lot of people think of it as a negative.
Absolutely. Yeah.
For me, it's not, you know, it's, how can you not be obsessed with something that you want to be great at? You have to be obsessed.
Right? We had lots of conversations after, you know, like, could we go cash? You know, we get that all the time, you know, a want and a need for him to do something lower keyed. We could have done it. We had way more opportunity to do yeah. that style than what we are
and
doing.
And people would have come.
And people would have come. It would have been just fine.
Yeah.
But his stupid obsession.
With, I believe the word is magnificent.
Yeah, okay, yes, sorry.
That's
his
right.
magnificent obsession. I went home. I remember we had a sit down at a coffee shop and I went home and I told my wife and I go, he ain't going to let go. There's no way he's going to let go. He has to have a thing that says, that's what I'm capable of, just so you know. That's what I do. This is my heart. This is my vision. This is my art. Now come have a chicken sandwich next door. You know, we'll get there.
And but. The only city that you could have done this was Chicago.
Only yeah. city we the ever would have even would've. Thought about it. Yeah. That was the most offensive thing that was ever asked of me after Grace was, are you guys going to stay in Chicago? Yeah. I would respond, how dare you, sir? How dare you,
we
sir?
We need more people to say that.
Yes, we do.
Why? Exactly.
Why?
When I moved here from California, did all the Chicagoans go, why'd you move here? What do we do to ourselves? We hate. It's so funny.
Well, winter sucks, let's be honest.
It does, but
we
so does
complain about it. That's the trade-off.
Interchange.
We get to complain about it, and then we feel better, and then we have like 6 weeks of this,
yeah,
and then we're back
100
in
days of summer.
Yeah. Right.
Like, I hope someone's listening to this podcast right now, sitting in traffic, in the right at the 101 interchange, right there, right in the pain of it.
And they're like, I'm going to move to Chicago.
And I'm telling that person
in
right
November.
Now, drive to the airport, leave everything, and come to Chicago.
That's right. Okay.
Well,
we
guys,
we gotta shift gears a little.
Yeah, we gotta lighten it up a little bit. So, our final segment that we have as part of the interview process is called Short Order. Which is like a little quick fire round where we ask you questions, don't think too hard, quick answer, and there's no wrong answers. We're going to ask each of you.
Duffy goes first.
Right.
Okay, yeah, so then you get, don't let his answer affect you. Stay pure.
I won't.
Okay.
So we're going to ask Curtis, and then you, and then back and forth. We'll do it that way.
Got it. Right.
So Curtis, what would you be doing if you were not a chef?
Rockstar.
Okay, I have a follow-up question. What kind of music?
Heavy metal.
Obviously.
Clearly.
Duh.
Yeah, he does have his high school haircut back, I can see.
I'm working on it.
You are. You're doing a good job. Michael, same question. What would you be doing if you were not a wine director, sommelier?
Photographer.
Curtis, who's your hero?
My father.
Michael? Yeah, of course, my dad.
Okay.
What did you have for breakfast today?
Oatmeal with peanut butter.
What did you
and
have for
breakfast?
And a plum.
I haven't eaten yet.
Coffee.
Coffee.
Yeah, coffee. Exactly. Yeah.
What movie will you always watch if you stumble upon it while flipping through channels?
Ooh. The Outsiders.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Wait, didn't somebody else say that in another podcast?
Am I yes.
Yeah, I think Rob Levitt maybe. Yeah.
Really?
That's kind of cool. You guys have something to talk
Mine
about?
Mine might surprise you. And I know this answer because this is my answer always for this. The color purple.
Love it.
If I come across it on whatever channel, it's on. I watch it to the, I can't yeah, not. Same. I have to watch it.
Curtis, if you have one, what is your life motto?
I'm stumped.
Okay, I'm stumped.
Crush it.
That's yours, Mike.
Crush it.
Savage. Push. That's his life motto. Push. Savage.
Push.
I say that thing all the time. This is not what you do. This is a representation of who you are. Okay. Take some like pride. It.
Yeah. That's good.
Curtis, what song will make you stop whatever you're doing and dance, or at least just bop your head?
No Reflection
by
Marilyn Manson.
Okay.
That I just bop my head?
Or stop what you're doing and dance.
Yeah.
Anything Prince.
Do you have a specific? Do you have an ultimate Prince?
Don't do that.
Erotic City?
No, it's deeper than that. Like the Pope.
Raspberry Beret.
Probably be the Pope.
Okay.
What is
you
your
can
last?
Be the president. Oh. I'd rather be the Pope. That one.
Just because, so we're clear which one it was.
Yeah.
What is your last request meal? No limitations.
Cooking. Can I cook?
Oh, yeah. No one's ever asked us this before.
Sure.
Yeah. Yes.
I would cook a meal for the kids for whatever they wanted because they all eat something different. So it's always four meals for different things. And something for my wife and I. Probably roast chicken, potatoes, and asparagus. Nice. Simple, clean.
This is last meal.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
I eat this meal no,
and then you die.
And then that's it.
And then that's it.
Yeah.
Lights out.
Really?
Yes.
That's your last meal.
I would also
no
add,
judgment. You know there's no part? Judgment.
Did you know that it's dead after that? This is not
well, that's
like
why I'm coming
you're not
back
living
to,
tomorrow.
I'm coming back to add a nice double tequila for my wife and I.
Wow.
Now it's complete. You can't judge. This is a safe
I would
space.
Like, ready? Yes. I'm ordering my last meal because tomorrow won't exist.
That's right.
The thing.
Yeah.
Okay. May I please have a Mexican pizza from Taco Bell with dollops of sour cream over each piece of it? I'll take two Doritos, Cool Ranch Doritos. Yeah.
I hate tacos, Cool Ranch Doritos.
Supreme. I got to have the sour cream inside that taco. That's my main. May I, before that, can I have a seven-layer burrito? I want a
extra
seven-layer
sour
burrito.
Cream.
No, as is, as is. But if you could please make sure that when you put the guacamole in there, you don't just hit the back of the burrito. I don't like that because then it's all,
it's important.
You know what I mean? Just evenly disperse the seven layers is what I'd prefer. And then for dessert, the cinnamon twists.
Anything you would drink, wine expert.
Yeah, probably like a, do you have Literai? I'd take a nice Pinot.
There you go.
Know,
like a,
yeah.
Okay. It. This is the favorite we always end on. Favorite curse word.
Fuck.
Yeah. Oh, anyone who would know me knows why I'm taking so much time to understand, like to really pick my favorite. It's probably motherfucker.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. And I also love
I have
that,
a favorite, but it's not appropriate to say.
No, don't
so
say,
I won't
it.
Say it.
Don't Ooh. Say it. No.
Okay.
I don't know what it is, but it scares the shit out of me.
Yeah,
what you might say.
That
so no.
Scary.
Don't. I love that. Yeah, I love that
don't
you guys.
We
are,
have to come back
Melissa
and do an
Harris
after
will
dark.
Thank me.
Yeah.
Overserved after
for
dark.
For sure.
All bets are off.
And I love that you guys are three Michelin starred, and all you want is Taco Bell. This is for everybody out there. If like for one thing that you don't know, all of the chefs that you revere and love and hold on a high pedestal, they all eat like crap. Not that Taco Bell is crap, but like. They do not eat the food that they make themselves. Just so you
I
know.
Have a feeling Curtis does not eat like crap.
I have my moments. I do.
Do you?
Yeah. I enjoy Taco Bell as well.
But
you are very disciplined.
Yeah, you seem disciplined.
He is. I think you are.
I try to be. Yeah.
I think you are. Yeah.
But then again, it's like everything else. It's a choice.
It is.
And then you have to make additional time that you don't have.
Yeah. Curtis, he's always taken his fitness like super serious. So it's never kind of wavered.
Yeah.
Really.
That's on brand.
Yeah. Well, guys, thank you so much for joining us in the studio at Mess Marketing in Westtown in Chicago with our esteemed producer, Ernest Wilkins. Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Guys, thanks for doing what you do, by the way. I think the podcast is fantastic.
Yeah,
it's an honor to be here. It's an honor to support it. So kick ass.
Yeah. Thank you, guys.
Of course.
Incredible.
Oh, you're not done yet. We have to taste some stuff.
Oh.
The Pope.
So every week on the podcast, we have our final segment is called Sip This, where we bring in something that either we've stumbled upon or more likely than not has been sent to us because Maggie and I both write about wine and spirits and other beverages. This week, we are enjoying, hopefully, it is Lil Fizz. It's this adorable little can of wine from No Fine Print, which was created by a now former Chicago beverage expert, Ryan Arnold. He used to be with Let Us Entertain You, and he's now, I want to say, out in Aspen. Great guy, incredibly talented, and he partnered up with Tim Smith, who manages Zed and Skrillex, and also Patrick Corcoran, who is Chance the Rapper's manager, to come up with this line. I've had their Cabernet Sauvignon, which is incredible. It is a really fantastic wine, super sippable, not like a big, heavy cab. But this is their answer to the portable beverage movement that we're experiencing
now. So
you're
feeding me wine in a can right now.
I sure
that's
am.
Right.
That's why I intentionally did that
this
to see what you think.
Coffee breakfast, mid-afternoon snack is fizzy
so
wine.
This
in a
is
can.
It comprise it
so
is
what is it?
It is 77% Sauvignon Blanc from Lake County in California, 16% Chardonnay from Sonoma, 7% rosé of Pinot Noir from Sonoma Carneros and Sonoma Valley. The Sauvignon Blanc was all fermented in stainless steel. The Chardonnay was fermented in a mix of neutral barrel and stainless steel. And that's all the information I have. So
taste
so
it
don't
and
ask
say
any
what
questions,
think.
Muser.
No. So bottoms up. Let's see what you think. And you could and honestly, like this is an open
are they
forum.
Are they a sponsor?
No.
None of these are these are things that we find and that we
but
speak
I know
honestly.
Ryan and I don't want him to get mad at me.
But if you don't like
but
it,
you
can
you
say
like
that.
It, you
where do you buy these?
In the store.
Wait, are they available at Benny's? And we don't know.
I don't know, actually. I think so.
You said Sauvignon Blanc Chardonnay.
And a rosé of Pinot.
And a Pinot rosé. Rosé.
I like it. It's you do, and the thing that I get frustrated with canned beverages is you oftentimes taste, no matter what it's lined with, you oftentimes taste the aluminum. On the end. I think the wine itself is actually pretty nice. You get that rosé coming through, even though it's a small percentage of the package. Michael's like dying to speak right now.
Well, here's why I'm not allowed to hate it. Because the most beautiful thing about wine is that it is this massive scale from $12,000 a bottle all the way down to that, right? That's why it's been such an amazing product for us as a bunch of animals, is that it can be had in any stretch of its imagination, all the way down to a Red Bull can,
right?
Is what I'm drinking here, basically. And for what it is, I think it's great.
It's kind of a sit in with toes in sand and just kind of don't think about it and throw it back.
Or you're on a boat,
right?
Or you're
like
at a concert, you're at Ravinia, you're at a picnic, whatever it is. I mean, that's what it's
for.
It
makes me wonder, because some of those parks, they don't allow alcohol, and you can't stop me with this.
Right.
No. I have also seen White Claw. I've seen White Claw on gates, on like every park bench.
Oh, yeah.
It's that shit.
Go to Hollywood Beach on any given weekend, otherwise known as the gay beach, and you will see everybody's drinking, and at the end of the day, there are mounds of bottles and beer cases and everything piled up around the garbage cans. And then there are signs that say no alcohol on the beach, and people are like, I don't know how to read.
Yeah. We went to Montrose Dog Beach super early on Sunday morning, And there was a scene of these three dudes laid out, passed out, asleep, and like the accoutrement of their beverage choices laid out in front of them. I mean, these guys, it was 7 o'clock in the morning. They were knocked out.
Well, they were up all night long.
They were.
What were they surrounded by?
There was some Hennessy.
Great.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There was a couple wine bottles. There was a Robert Mondavi White Zinfandel bottle. That, like, it was a bizarre mix of, like, how'd you get there? You know what I mean?
Going back to Lil Fizz, which I love the name, by the way. It's like a little rapper,
you
Lil
Fizz. You can buy it online.
You can get it online.
You can buy it online, yeah.
But I will say, like, for whatever we were saying initially about, like, you could taste the metal at the end or the aluminum, it makes me want to keep drinking it. It is actually, it is
quite quaffable, Ari.
It is quite quaffable.
And it's crushable.
Crushable, as the sign says on the side of the can.
Yeah, a friend used to call them patio pounder. It's a patio pounder.
Yeah. So anybody, if you...
Real quick, Ari, there actually is an R&B singer named Lil Fizz.
He's for real?
A key member of the influential 2000s group B2K. Huh.
Thank you, Ernest Wilkins, our music historian.
For the record, I knew that.
Yeah. No. So as I said, we do sip this in every episode. If there's anything out there that you think we should be sipping, let us know. Send us an email to overservedpod@gmail.com and send us any feedback, anything. As I've said in the past, if you have something mean to say, don't send us an email. We don't want to know.
The
world, there's enough hate in the world. Just send us your love.
There's a reason we didn't make a Twitter account.
Yeah. Go be mean somewhere else, everybody.
But guys, again, thank you so much for joining us this week. It's a true pleasure and honor to have you here with us in the studio. And for those of you listening, thank you again for tuning in to another episode of Overserved. You will hear us.
There we go.
Next time.
Bye.
Take care.